Welcome back to the Education Matters podcast. We've got a historic special one today. We have a guest host, Scott Kinney, our president, who was a recent guest on the podcast. He's done his own podcast with Dr. Diana Green, who's a really distinguished Capella graduate. She graduated with a PhD in education from Capella in 2007. And earlier this year, she was sworn in as the interim superintendent of Manatee County Schools in Florida. And she has a remarkable story, a tremendous passion for education, and a career filled with highlights. And in the interest of highlighting really extraordinary Capella graduates, Scott sat down and had a really great conversation with her. It was so good that I'm worried he's going to take over this podcast. But I hope you guys enjoy it, listening to it as much as I did. Dr. Green has a really great story that everyone associated with Capella can be proud of. So without further ado.
I'm here today with Dr. Diana Green, and Dr. Green had planned to join us at our all-employee meeting at the end of June here at Capella. But because that didn't work out, we've got an even better opportunity to spend a little bit more time with her. So first of all, Dr. Green, welcome. It's great to have you on.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be asked to speak with you today.
The pleasure is all ours. So let's just start with, tell us a little bit about what you do and what inspired you to go back to school to get your degree. You're a Capella alum. You earned your PhD here a number of years ago, but you've done some really interesting things in the K-12 arena. So just tell us a little bit about what you're doing and how that came to be.
Well, today I'm the superintendent of Manatee County Public Schools. We serve about 48,000 students. So in the United States, that's considered to be a large school district.
Absolutely.
However, in Florida, we're what we call large, but we're not extra large because we have districts that serve students well into 230,000. So we're considered a large school district. I actually started Capella University because I was a deputy superintendent, and I felt if I wanted to become superintendent, I needed to go back and go back to school for my PhD. And it definitely was something I had to think about. I was a mom of two great young men, and a wife, and being deputy superintendent. And at that time, I was in another school district, Marion County, which at that time was about 42,000 students. So, again, a large school district, a lot of responsibility. And during my research, I met a teacher in my district who was working on her PhD, and she told me she was going through Capella. And I said, okay, tell me more about it. And she shared with me about Capella University, and then I did my own research, and I felt that this was the best school for me that had different types of degrees, and for me, I wanted a PhD. I didn't want an EdD, which there's nothing wrong with, but I just decided for me that that's what I wanted, and so that's how I got involved, got started through Capella.
So when you think about the district that you're now the superintendent of, Manatee, tell me a little bit about the students and some of the challenges and that you face as the leader of such a large district.
Well, we have a very diverse population. Our population is 50% Caucasian, 50% minority, and the largest minority group are our Hispanic students. So our Hispanic students constitute almost 37% of our population, and then African American students, some 12%, and then 1 or 2% of other ethnicities, and one of the ethnicities that's starting to grow is Haitian Creole. Mm. We have them in pockets. So our challenge is that we have a very diverse population, and many of our students come from poverty. Our poverty level, based on free and reduced lunch rate, is about 67%. So we have quite a few challenges that we are trying to overcome. Many of our students come to us, especially our Hispanic students, with language as their barrier, because many of our over 12% of our population is considered what we call ESOL, English speakers of other languages. So that's even in the state of Florida, that's a large percentage that of students who we have to provide additional services for them to, one, be able to handle the text and the vocabulary and the language of English when many of those students aren't quite proficient in their native language.
Right.
So they may be illiterate in their native language, and we're trying to help them learn a new language, and whether that's verbal or written language, and that is very challenging.
It certainly sounds like a challenge. If I remember correctly, the Manatee District was awarded an A-plus rating by the Florida State Department of Education for achievements that it had made in student performance, and particularly lifting up some of the students who had historically performed at the lowest levels and making a significant reduction in the number of students who were rated at that lowest level of attainment. Are there one or two areas that you feel particularly proud of or that you particularly focused on in order to achieve those kinds of results?
Well, I've only been in Manatee County for 2 years. I actually came to Manatee County as the deputy superintendent, and I've been the superintendent since May 27th.
Congratulations, by the way. Yeah, that's very exciting.
So this is relatively a new position for me. We did come in with a very strong initiative to jumpstart, if you will, our student achievement. But interesting enough, I just shared with the board an analogy that, you know, when I got married, I wanted to lose 10 pounds, so I went on this crash diet, and I did lose the 10 pounds. But after about 2 weeks later, all the weight came back because I did not make a systematic change in my lifestyle. I did something to jumpstart losing that amount of weight, but did not make the necessary changes to make it consistent. Well, that's where we are as a school district. We came in, we jump-started it, and had dramatic change in results, but now we are building something that's going to be more sustainable as we move through as our students matriculate through our school system. So last year, we implemented Title I pre-K for the first time, catching many more of our students of poverty, much earlier before they arrive in kindergarten, and working on those language acquisition skills and providing that early learning for them. So we instituted that particular initiative. We're also working with our community on, through the Patterson Foundation, the grade level reading initiative. That initiative is our goal to ensure that by third grade, all of our students are reading on grade level and are proficient. So part of that initiative was starting the Title I pre-K. This year, we will now move to phase two, which is addressing chronic absenteeism. In our Title I schools, 31% of our students miss 10 or more days. Of that 31%, 10% of them miss more than 25 days of school. So it is very clear, if they're not here, we really can't support them, teach them, and if we're not supporting them and teaching them, they're not going to be achieving. So that is part of a more comprehensive plan that we're trying to put together to ensure that, yes, we jumpstart, and yes, the state of Florida recognizes us for great improvements, but that those improvements will not stay without creating a systemic change in what we are doing for our students. So those are just two. We have five other initiatives that we are instituting, you know, at the middle school and high school, trying to provide that support no matter where students are on the spectrum of the K-12 spectrum.
So those kinds of challenges are really complex problems, and they're faced by hundreds, if not thousands, of districts around the country that also have higher percentages of students who are coming out of poverty or who are part of immigrant families. One thing you mentioned really caught my attention. Here in Minnesota, there's been a recent debate about funding for pre-K, early childhood family education and pre-K education. And there was a pretty significant increase. The legislature voted in a pretty big increase, but it was a big topic with a lot of debate. Is that a particular interest of yours, and do you think that that is one of the keys to addressing these very complex problems?
Oh, it is definitely one of the keys to addressing the issue of early learning and catching them very early, because once they have fallen behind, it is very challenging to help them catch up. But it can't be done in isolation alone. We, in the state of Florida, has free VPK. It is a half day program, 4 hours. So we have, our district has three different types of VPK. We have the free VPK for all of our students for 4 hours. And then for those schools who parents can afford, they pay for the other 4 hours. So the parents pay for the other 4 hours for the students to be in school for a full school day. We have the Title I VPK, which the 4 hours are paid by the state, and then we use our federal Title I dollars to pay the other 4 hours of the day. And then we have what we call VPK integrated, where it's an inclusion class. Six of the students are ESE students. They're developmentally delayed, and thereby we get dollars from the state for VPK, and then the state dollars that pay for ESE funds the remainder part of the day for those students, as well as some of the students are paying in the afternoon. So through those efforts, we are getting to more and more of our students earlier. But one of the things that I didn't mention that we are now following up is that our Title I schools, we're instituting Camp Rise. It is a summer school program. So as we work really hard with them during the year, research shows children of poverty, when summer hits, they have summer slide. And so they're starting again the very next year, sort of 2 months behind their peers who may not have those same challenges. And so that's why I continue to use that analogy that we are doing a lifestyle change, if you will, for public education by instituting early learning, pre-K, summer programs for our children of poverty. We're addressing our chronic absenteeism issue. And those are things that we're changing district-wide to support our students as they matriculate through our system.
Diana, are you more of an optimist or a pessimist or a realist, somewhere in between, when you think about the next 10 years of K-12 education in this country, particularly in districts like yours?
Well, when I look at the people who work with our students each and every day, I have to be an optimist. But when I deal with the issues coming from whether it's state or federal, I become a realist. It is somewhere along the way, we've lost the perspective of what public education is supposed to be. It is more than just test scores. I'm very concerned that there is this movement to dismantle public education. And we are the lifeline, especially for children of poverty. Public education is the only institution that allows any and everyone access. And when I look at what we're doing for our students, we are not only providing them access, we are providing them high-quality access and equity amongst our students to ensure that each and everyone has an opportunity to graduate from high school, because it is very clear, without a high school diploma, we are only adding to the crime rate, the poverty rate. We're only continuing to add to a path of self-destruction as a society if we do not decide that we're going to educate every student, no matter their ethnicity, their poverty, their situations in which where they come, their language. We have to make that decision, but I am very optimistic because of the people who I work with each and every day who are also committed and optimistic about what we're doing in our school district. And so it really does start with a very strong vision, the support of a school board that's willing to focus on educating our students, and then the adults, the employees, all making a commitment to high-quality education for the students, because that is our business. Our business is education and educating students. It's not about the adults. It's about ensuring that we can have a very strong future by teaching them today.
That's very well said, Dr. Green. I can hear the passion coming through that you have for addressing these opportunities to help lift children out of poverty through education, but the challenges and the barriers that you face along the way. It's certainly quite a path to navigate. Now, you received your PhD from Capella a while ago. Is it back in 2007, 2008? Is that right?
2006.
Actually. Okay. So coming 9 years ago. Was your work and your dissertation work in particular, has that been something you could apply throughout your career, or is it something that you it's been quite a while now. Is it something that you still think about from time to time?
Oh, actually, I still use my work from my dissertation. In the state of Florida, there is a state statute requirement of mandatory retention in third grade for any student that the first flag is that they score level one on our state assessment. And then, you know, there are other opportunities that they can demonstrate that they are at least at what the state would say a level two, which would be probably what most people would say is basic for that grade level. My work, my dissertation, surrounded something we call the model third grade classroom. We had to figure out how are we going to support these students with this mandatory retention. The first year, we had over 700 third graders who were up for retention. And even though we used the portfolio and we used summer school, 500 of them were retained in third grade. And we believed that we could not just give them a different teacher and think the results would be better. So we created a program called the Model Third Grade. It was built on the premise that all subjects can be taught through two subjects, reading and math. So science, social studies, English, everything was taught through teaching reading and math. We were so successful, 98% of the students passed that very next year the state assessment. And over 60%, I believe, passed at what the state calls proficient, level three. So we were very excited about what we had accomplished. But a part of me kept thinking, well, does this last? Does this effect of them being at proficiency last when they go to fourth grade, to fifth grade, to sixth grade? So my research was to go back and look at the students who were promoted for cause. Remember, if I said they could demonstrate that they could be proficient through other means, whether through summer school or a portfolio, those students were promoted. So that was one control group, the group that was promoted through those means, the retained group that went through the model classroom, and then there were a number of retained students whose parents chose not to participate in the model classroom, or they were, at that time, if they were in an ESE classroom, they could be promoted if they had been retained in K-1 or 2. So we had three different groups that we were tracking. And the first year, after the initial retention and after going through the model, statistically, the students who were in the third grade model outscored those other students the following year. However, when you track them into middle school at their sixth grade year, there was no statistical difference between the students who were in the model, the students who were promoted for that for cause, and then those students who just went through a previous retention or did not participate in the model and was retained. So that clearly, even though we created a white paper to share with the Department of Education indicating that retention, based on my research, is still not a positive intervention, if you will, that would sustain students from being at a higher level or closing the gap. It showed that initially it does, but it's only short term. And so what my conclusion was that if they do not have that strong program for multiple years, the students basically kind of revert back to where they were prior to even being retained.
Yeah.
And that there was no difference.
Well, that's...
So it actually impacted policy for my school district.
Yeah.
That the district chose not to retain any students unless they are state mandated. So the only retention that occurred in the district in which I did the study occurs at third grade. It's the only one.
Very interesting how research can produce counterintuitive results, but foundational results that affect policy and kind of pave the way for the next round of experimentation and analysis to see what can work and in such an important area. Well, you clearly, 9 years later, still have a firm hold on the research work that you did as part of your PhD. Diana, two sort of short answer final questions here, and this has been great. I really, I could talk to you all day. But first, one group that I think will be particularly interested in listening to this interview is the faculty of our School of Education, so our core faculty, our part-time and adjunct faculty, and especially those who work with the several thousand learners we have at the master's, EDD, PhD degree programs in P-12 education. If you were going to give our faculty who work with those educators who are in their own ways trying to address many of the same challenges that you are, any advice for our faculty who are listening in?
Well, the only advice I have is that they would continue to remain close to the practice of education. And what I mean by that, even in pursuing my doctorate, I would go visit those classrooms. I would watch what was happening in the third grade model. I continue to provide professional development to my own teachers in my own school district. And what that does is it gives me continued a sense of understanding what they are going through, understanding the changes that are happening. And sometimes we can not be involved or see the daily interaction of what's happening, that we can become a little backwards is not the right word, but a little
removed,
our thinking
distant.
Can be a little distant from what's really happening.
Yeah, I think it's
a perfect example. Now are the new standards, the Common Core. In Florida, they're called the Florida Standards. If college professors are not coming to our schools and seeing what our teachers are doing, it's easy to just teach the textbook, but what makes it come to life is actual experience, understanding what challenges we are having in the classroom teaching those standards. What things we have had to change in our instructional pedagogy to address those standards. So that's my only advice, is to continue to not only improve their own education, but visit a classroom, work with a teacher, partner with a school if they can. It's just that I see so many of our students, they are craving, I just need some more information, or I want to see what that looks like in my classroom. And I know at the master's level, most of the students are in schools, but they also need to see that their professor, their instructor is still connected. And they understand what they're going through.
Absolutely. I think that's great advice, Dr. Green. And as you know, Capella believes strongly in our scholar-practitioner model. But having said that, there are always opportunities for our faculty to get closer to current practice in the classrooms. A lot of our education faculty are teachers or administrators in school districts, so they're living it every day. But for our core faculty, our full-time faculty, I know that they're passionate about education, and it's always a good reminder that you got to get in there and see what people are doing. Last question. It's 2:30 in the afternoon, your time, on July 2nd in Florida. How's the weather outside?
Believe it or not, it's really bad. Yeah. I'm hoping I could stay on the phone because I see lightning strikes all around me.
No, I assumed it was about 140 degrees.
I will tell you, I'm in a five-story building overlooking the Manatee River, so I have the most spectacular view of probably any superintendent in the country. But when the weather's bad, I have a real good view also of lightning strikes all around out there.
All right. Well, I don't want to keep you in harm's way, so get under your desk, take cover, and thank you so much for joining me today. It was great to talk with you. We're sorry that we missed you in Minneapolis, but in a way, this allowed us to get into a lot more depth. The work you're doing is really important. I think you know that. I think anybody who's a parent or a taxpayer in this country realizes that, and we couldn't be prouder of you as one of our alumni, and we wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you very much, and I truly enjoyed speaking with you, and hopefully I'll get another chance to come to Minneapolis.
Well, we would love that. Have a great day and a very safe
thank you.
July 4th weekend.
Thank you. The same to you.
Thanks, Dr. Green.